Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we're going to talk about being prepared for an emergency. We're going to have Elaine Lassoff with us in just a few minutes, so stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this message. Thank you.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
Hi there. We're back. I think we're on the air now. Sorry about that. We were having some technical difficulties. So if you heard a lot of blank space, I'll just start over again. This is Joyce Graff, and this is The Powerful Patient. And you can tell this is our second show, so we are still having some breaking in issues, I'm afraid. But we will try to get this going as quickly as possible. Sorry about that. It's a new platform. It's a great new capability, and we're looking forward to it. But right now, things are a tad rough, so please be indulgent here for a second. So we're talking today about emergency preparedness, and there's a lot that you can do, not only for your own self personally, but also for your community in helping to get your community ready for an emergency. Every community has only a certain number of police and fire, and lately, with all the budget cuts that various communities are going through, those resources are shrinking. So here in my town, we have about 150 police people and about 150 firefighters, and we only have a certain amount of resource that's available. So if there's a major event, like a fire or something like that, then we can overrun the resources that are available from the police people and the fire people. So what we've learned is that we need to have some volunteers in the community who are trained, who are ready, who are willing, that can be called upon in an emergency. And I'm actually a volunteer in my community, which is Brookline, Massachusetts. I'm part of what's called the Community Emergency Response Team, the CERT team. And actually, I went first to renew my CPR and first aid. I wanted to make sure that those were up to date. And so I inquired about where I could get that training. And they said, well, actually, we are recruiting for this Community Emergency Response Team, the CERT team. And if you're willing, we will make sure that you get the training that will upgrade your CPR and your first aid. And in addition, get you ready to be one of these volunteers to supplement the police and fire. Now, I've gone through the training. I've been on the team now for about 2 years. And a couple of the things that I was called upon to do this winter would be relevant to your own thinking about emergency preparedness. One of them is that we had some very intense ice storms here in central Massachusetts this winter. And those of you who don't live in frosty parts of the United States may not know what an ice storm is. An ice storm is a really an incredible phenomenon where you sort of get rain that covers all of the trees and everything, and then it freezes up. And so everything is covered with a little layer of ice. Sometimes it's an eighth of an inch. Sometimes it may even be a half an inch of ice all over every tiny little branch on every tree. And let me tell you, they are gorgeous. It is so beautiful. It looks like a fairyland. But, of course, they're wicked treacherous. You can't walk. You can't even drive, really, in an ice storm. And the most treacherous part of it is that it makes all those branches very brittle. They become like glass. And they also become very heavy. So the trees will fall down. And they may fall down on your house or on your car or on you. And the biggest thing they do is they fall on power lines, and they take the power lines down. So what happened in central Massachusetts this winter was that we had a terrible ice storm that took down power lines, fell on houses, made big holes in roofs, and so people were displaced. They had no heat in the middle of this very cold time, and sometimes they had a hole in the roof. So here you have the wind whipping through on your roof, and you really couldn't stay in the house. So what we did was we set up centers where people could go. I was part of a team that opened a shelter in the gymnasium of a local high school, and we had about 50 people there, some of whom were from a nearby nursing home. And we were trying to make sure that everybody was safe and warm and had what they needed to eat. And for most people, this was a place to sleep. For the people from the nursing home, they brought some staff from the nursing home. We had a number of people there who had Alzheimer's disease, and so we needed to keep them safe, make sure they didn't wander off, make sure that everybody was not too anxious. You can imagine elderly people, when they're in an environment that's not their normal environment, there's a certain level of anxiety that kicks in, and so we were supplementing what the staff from that nursing home was able to do for those residents. And then we had people from the community with small children, keeping them entertained and making sure they had cookies and juice and whatever they needed. And one little girl who was about 18 months old walked the halls until midnight. I think I left a little after midnight, and she was still going strong, and her mother was wandering with her up and down the halls of the high school. So it was quite an adventure. But for you, and think in terms of with you and your abilities and disabilities, with your medical needs, what would happen to you in a situation like that, where all of a sudden your home is not a place where you can stay? You're going to need to go to a shelter. You may be there for several days. Some of these people were there for a week. And what would you need to take with you? What do you need to know? What information? What medication? What clothing would you need to take with you in order to be safe? And that's basically what is going on here. The other thing, the other occasion that I had to deal with the CERT team just recently, I got a call from them at 3:30 in the morning that there had been a fire at a high-rise apartment building for elderly citizens of my community, and they needed people to come and sit with some of the people who had been displaced. So this is a very nice high-rise apartment building. It's very well run, but one lady on the 10th floor had accidentally started a fire. And the fire department came, they put out the fire, but of course water runs downhill. So in the course of putting out the fire on the 10th floor, they caused enough water to go downward through all of the apartments underneath hers, that there was water all over the floor and the places were simply not habitable. Elaine's having trouble dialing in. So we're going to play a little ad for you here and talk with Elaine, see if we can get her on the line. Okay, thanks. Anita, you want to play a little music for us, please? You're the one who has my mic. Hi, It's Joyce Graffit. We're back again. And hopefully Elaine's going to be able to join us in just a moment. She was having some trouble getting on, but we should see her number coming up here in just a second. So anyway, starting at 3:30 in the morning, I'm sitting in the vestibule of the apartment building talking with people who were there in their fuzzy slippers. There were about a dozen people who had been displaced from their apartments. All the 05 apartments on 10 floors of this building had been displaced, and the fire department didn't want them to go up there at all because the floor was wet. They didn't want people to fall down, and there was no electricity, so everything was very dark. So then we had to sit there and say, okay, you're going to be going to a hotel. We don't know for how long, but what do you need to take with you? And this is a key question for everybody thinking in terms of what you need to do to prepare yourself for some eventuality like this. If you had to go to a hotel for 2 days plus, what do you need to know? What do you need to take with you? Who do you need to contact to let them know what's going on? So I'll just give you a few of the scenarios that we went through to give you an idea so that you can start thinking about this. The first thing, of course, was everybody's medications. They needed to get their medications. One lady had them all in a plastic bag and just grabbed her plastic bag on the way out the door, and so she came with her medications in hand. But for most of the other people, we had to send a fireman up to find their medications and where are they and how many bottles are we looking for and so forth. And so it was much more difficult to deal with. Some clothes, just one change of clean clothes, even a sweatsuit will do, but where are your things? And, you know, if you had them put together, that would be nice. Otherwise, you've got some random fireman going through your underwear drawer to get you what you need for the next day. So a change of clothing is nice to have assembled. And the third major thing was the address book. Where is my list of telephone numbers so that I can get in touch with the key people who might want to get in touch with me? And my phone's just going to ring off the hook. My answering machine will fill up. How do I notify these people that I'm all right and where I am and so forth? So those were the three major things, the first things that come up. And particularly if there's some medication that you must take, so for example, if you have diabetes or if you have some other condition for which you take a medication that is required, a transplant is another example of the kinds of things that you need to take the medications, all those medications you need to have. And they usually recommend 2 or 3 days' worth of medication. If you have that with you, then there's usually time to get more from a nearby pharmacy. Now, in the case of a major disaster, you may need to have more than that. But great. So Elaine's going to join us here in just 1 second. You may need to have more than that if you're in a major disaster because the pharmacies themselves may be having a hard time getting resupply. So depending on how critical this is, you can gauge whether you might need to have more than 2 days' worth of medication, but certainly 2 days is a good starting point. And I think we have Elaine with us on the line. Do we have Elaine?
Yes, you do.
Hi, welcome.
Hi, Joyce.
Thank you. So apologies for the technical problems that we've been having here, but one of these days we'll get our act together.
That's quite all right. I was listening to you for a little while. You certainly have a wealth of knowledge.
Oh, great. So this is Elaine Lasloff from Needham, Massachusetts. Elaine, would you please introduce yourself a little bit and tell us about your own background?
First of all, thank you for inviting me to be on the program. I know it's going to be a little shorter than we planned. I'm a registered nurse with a bachelor's and master's degree in nursing and an advanced graduate degree in trauma with a subspecialty in burns. I have spent most of my career working with severely traumatized patients, whether it's from a disaster, whether it's, well, generally they're all disasters, and they're in that case, many, many burn patients, and whether it's natural or such as a hurricane, or now we are concerned about terrorist attacks.
Right.
What I do is I'm the director of education at the Needham Emergency Management Agency, which is part of the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency and Federal Emergency Management Agency, or now called the Department of Homeland Security.
And right, so you're part of the Needham CERT, as I was describing, which is part of MEMA, Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency, which is part of FEMA. So if we use those acronyms as we go forward, you'll know what they mean.
Sure.
Great.
And what I do is I work with emergency responders, police, fire, EMTs, paramedics, in trying to prevent a major disaster from happening. Or they may be called out for something, and we try to get in there to make sure that it doesn't turn into anything worse. What I do is I teach volunteers. We currently have about 12 volunteers with a variety of backgrounds. And I train them in emergency preparedness, disaster preparedness. What would they do? How would we keep people safe? How do you keep people safe in an emergency? And as I said before, it used to be tornadoes or hurricanes or earthquakes, and 9/11 just opened up a whole new ballgame for us. Part of the position is teaching them enough information so that they can come in and help the responders or get a head start on the responders. It might take police a while to get there and firefighters a while to get to an area. What my volunteers do is get everything prepared, make sure everybody is stable. We have a variety of backgrounds of people. They do not have to be necessarily medical to work in it, but they need to have a background with something where they can help out, even if it's serving food to people who are coming to a shelter. And there are just a number of different things that they can do. All of my staff are CPR certified. They also are all Red Cross certified in shelter management. And basically what I want to do is make sure that if people hear of something on the news, and the way television is lately, they tend to blow everything out of proportion, and everybody goes into a state of panic.
This is true. Yeah, there's going to be a foot of snow tomorrow, and then there's like 3 inches on the ground.
Right, exactly. And I think the best one was President Obama's daughter last week after one of the snowstorms, and they called school off, and she just came home and said, "Daddy, that would have been our recess." You know, I mean, why are they calling school off for a couple of inches?
Because she's from Chicago, where they know how to deal with snow, and in Washington, you know, a skim coat of snow will freeze the city to a grinding halt.
Exactly. And it was never like that when I was growing up, but now everything is closed down. Just a couple of days ago, everything was closed down. You couldn't get to a mailbox. We couldn't get our mail. And there was just a little bit of snow, but the weather, you know, for tomorrow, they're talking about a mixture of snow and ice. Mm-hmm. And today it's in the 50s. So we do need to be prepared and for anything, but hopefully not blowing everything out of proportion, because that is what the media is doing. And what everybody does who hears this, they all call 911. If they hear the tiniest sound, if they feel the tiniest pain or something, they think that something is happening. If they hear any noise, they feel that that's a terrorist attack, and they call 911.
Well, that's part of that anxiety that we were talking about before, too. And so the more we've thought ahead about emergencies and sort of rehearsed in our minds or done a drill, the more comfortable we'll be when a real emergency does occur.
Exactly. And that's one of the things we also do is hold a number of drills throughout the year. We have a 24/7 emergency operations center. Not every town does. Then that's where mass emergency management, you usually see them on the radio, on television or on the radio,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of cover for the state, because we're all running around trying to get our neighborhoods all situated. We do have a shelter. And if we expect that it is really going to be bad, people are notified. We have a computerized system here that will call every household in the town. And we are trying to get this standardized so that everybody, you know, throughout the state, throughout the country, has something like this. And this is where we're working with FEMA.
Yeah, is that called the reverse 911 system?
It's a form of the reverse 911.
Right. It's an automated dialing system, and
right.
some of the school systems are now beginning to use it. I know one of my friends said the other day she got a call at 5 o'clock in the morning telling her that it was going to be a snow day. But it's an automated voice that
mm-hmm.
calls you up and gives you some essential information. And it's a very useful thing now that telephone is pretty pervasive. Almost everybody has some kind of a telephone. And so to be able to get that kind of information without even turning on your radio is a wonderful thing.
That's correct. One of the terms that we use now, or you hear many times, and most people don't know what it is, but again, the news will tell you that everything is in lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
The schools are in lockdown. Nobody knows what that is. What they forget to do is explain what it is. And basically, it means that there's a concern that there is something going on near a school or in a neighborhood of a school, and they don't want the children to leave at the end of the day. They're safe to stay in. Nobody gets in, nobody gets out until the authorities have allowed us to let them out.
Right,
and
so something dangerous is happening in the environment around the school, and the decision's been made that the children will be safer if they're in the school, locked into the school, and not having parents come pick them up. So it's actually a danger if the parents come near the school to pick them up, because there is some danger happening.
Exactly, and that right now is probably the hardest part of people understanding lockdown. Parents naturally are going to want to get their kids and bring them home. To them, that's where they're safest. But it's not always true. And if the authorities from emergency management determine that it is best for them to stay in school, even if it's all day, overnight, whatever, this is where emergency management agency comes in. We have cots. We have all the food that they want. We will take care of them. And even if they have to stay in for a couple of days, and this telephone system will let parents know, please do not come to the school. In this day where everybody from 5 years old up has a cell phone, they can always call their children. We also have, if it's not an incident like that, but if the weather is just so bad where it's unsafe for them to leave, or there's a power outage, again, a cell phone that is fully charged is a big help. We also, in that case, we'll use ham radios to contact everybody. It started out as a difficult trying to get a hold of everybody by ham radio, and now with this system where they get a computerized call, it's really made a big difference. And we always get a wonderful thank you, and when they come down. When they're given the information to come down to pick up their children, that it is safe, everybody in town is out. And
so communications is a very essential piece of this puzzle, right?
Extremely. It's the most
important.
One
of the things we learned with Hurricane Katrina was that when that happened, the police people and the fire people couldn't even communicate with one another. They each
mm-hmm.
had communication systems that worked well within the police or within the fire system, but they were not able to talk to one another.
Okay.
And the same thing with the Army and the Coast Guard and all the other first responders that needed to be on the scene. had no way to communicate with one another. So that's one of the things we've been working hard to remedy since then. There are new walkie-talkies and things like that that maybe you can give us more information about it, but that allow these various systems to talk with one another in an emergency.
That's extremely important. And you're right, Katrina was an example of everything that can go wrong if there is poor communication. One of the things that did come out of that, we try to think of it that out of anything bad that happens, something good will also happen.
Right.
And from that experience, everybody started getting trained in various forms of communication, like ham radios. We have had hundreds of thousands of dollars in telephone systems that are in place now, and so that everybody can communicate. What we have here is one number, just one telephone number, and that is police, fire, paramedics, EMTs, any public works, anything like that becomes activated. So everybody is on the same page, basically.
Right. And depending what the crisis is, we never know which of those systems are going to be working and which of them are not going to be working. I know during 9/11, some of the cell phone towers were out, so the cell phones were not working, but the internet was working, so we could do instant messaging into New York. So there's all kinds of things. The computer systems, the networking systems, the cell phones, and the landlines are three different technologies, and hopefully one or two of those are going to be working.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
For the most part, I think since 9/11 we have come a long way with the communication system.
Right. The infrastructures are also stronger now.
That's true. That's true. What I also do is teach the volunteers shelter management, and staying in a shelter is not something that is a terrible experience if they do need to evacuate. And we have people, if all of us are trained in shelter management at all different levels, but we have one person who's a musician, and she could not understand why I asked her to join emergency management. But that particular year, we were in the shelter a number of times. It was around Y2K, and the town had to come there a number of times. And I would just call her up, and we get a piano moved into the shelter. We have enough cots for several hundred people. We have contracts with all the supermarkets. We have contracts with the veterinarians. And what she would do, an incredibly talented musician, people would sit around and she'd lead a sing-along.
And now, you said you actually had people moved into the shelters multiple times around Y2K?
We did ourselves as far as drills, but we also opened it up to the community so that they would know what they were going to see. We had it set up exactly.
Huh.
Like
that's a good idea. For those of you who don't remember, Y2K, which means 2000, the year 2000, there were a lot of dire predictions that because the computers didn't know how to deal with the year 2000, they were used to dealing with a two-character date, so 96 versus 98, but then when you got to 00, they didn't know how to cope, and they were afraid that security systems would fail because the date would screw up the ability to open the door, that the utilities were going to fail, there wouldn't be water or there wouldn't be gas or various things like that, all kinds of terrible, dire predictions, almost none of which, by the way, came true. One of the amusing stories from Y2K is that a lady in Minnesota was invited to join the kindergarten class. She was actually 105 years old. But she got invited along with the 5-year-olds. So there were a lot of amusing tales like that. Not too many terrible, awful things, but you're right. We were prepared for it, and you invited not only your volunteers and your first responders to participate in the drill, but you opened it up so that the community could see what it would be like, right?
Right, that it is not a frightening area. We have a teen area. We have a VCR, or I guess we've come a little further in terms of technology.
Right.
But we have all kinds of TVs and CD players, and they have a good time. They don't want to leave.
Yeah, well, I participated in a drill just recently, and it's very interesting. I mean, just imagine in your mind, we took over the athletic building of one of the universities here nearby to be a shelter, and we just did a kind of dress rehearsal. Let's pretend that there's some outbreak of terrible influenza or something, and the hospitals are overwhelmed, and we're doing a kind of a triage center here in this athletic building. We need to set up cots. We need to have a place to feed people. How are people going to register here? How are we going to keep track of who is mm-hmm. in the building, who's not in the building? The children are going to go here to play and so forth. So you have to work out all of that, including, as you said, the entertainment. And so maybe think, we'll ask our listeners to challenge themselves to think in terms of what they would need for folks like themselves, and what they might be able to contribute in a situation like that. Would they be willing to sit at the desk and greet people and write down their names and do record keeping or serve food or help with entertainment or helping take care of the children?
Right. We have a person who has a daycare center in town, and she won't go to the daycare center. She brings the daycare center to the shelter. And everything, the shelter that we have, we can get it set up. We've timed ourselves. And we can set up 150 cots and have everything ready within 30 minutes.
Wow, that's terrific.
And we have platters and platters of food that just can last for days. And I just do want to mention about how many days, if there is a disaster. I want to get a little bit into that also. But there is something for pretty much anybody. We certainly need our communications people. We certainly need our nurses and doctors and firefighters. But we also need people who can just sit and talk.
Just extra hands, or as you say, to just sit and chat with people, because of that anxiety factor. In a situation like this, people get anxious, and if there's no way to calm them down, it'll spiral out of control. So it's better for everybody if we can keep people feeling calm, feeling it's going to be okay. It's not ideal at the moment, but it'll be okay. And that was the primary thing that I was doing at that apartment building for elder citizens. We had 12 people just sort of waiting for Dunkin' Donuts to open up so that we could get some coffee and donuts, which we did, but also helping them just not to get freaked out about the fact that their apartment was sort of underwater.
That's right. What I found with Y2K and was the people that called, I was doing dispatch. We had a special emergency line, again, to keep people away from calling 911. And they called this one number. A few of us were trained in this. It was a new computerized system, mm-hmm. telephone system. And with the exception of one transformer that blew that had nothing to do with Y2K, all of the calls were from elderly people who lived alone, who were very, very frightened.
Yeah.
And but we didn't do it at that time, but what we've learned since then is we have the facilities to open up a shelter. And if something like this happened again, where we needed, you know, we're not going to see the year 3000, but if this were to happen again, if it was 2000, Y2K all over again, we would have the shelter open, and anybody who wanted to come, who did not feel safe or comfortable, particularly if they live by themselves. We would pick them up. That's another thing that we do. We could provide a service with, they might arrive on a fire truck, fire engine,
right.
or via police car, or but we would bring them in ahead of time so that they feel safe. And that.
So that brings up a good point. If you have a mobility issue, or if there's someone who is deaf or blind and needs assistance,
mm-hmm.
might not even hear an alarm, then you need to register them with the fire department. And the fire department does maintain a registry of go looking for these people because these people may not hear you and they need assistance.
Exactly. We do require registration when somebody comes into the shelter. And initially people didn't want to. They said it was privacy issues.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want us to know where they live or whatever. And trying to explain that we're not trying to get into your personal life. We're trying to keep you safe. And if a family member calls, we need to be able to say, your mother is here and she is safe.
Yeah, about midnight in that shelter during the ice storm, two policemen came in and said, do you have John Smith or whatever the name was? And we did have our registration list. We were able to confirm it. Why did they want to know? Because John's son, who lives in another state, had phoned the police and said, I can't get in touch with my father. Can you check on him? I'm worried about him.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that he had done anything wrong, not at all, but we were trying, as you said, to make sure he was safe and to reassure his relations that he was okay.
Right.
So they were able to bring a cell phone over to him and put him in touch with his son, and that worked out really well.
Exactly.
You and I had talked before about some of the things that people can do in advance to make sure that if they are going to have what they need and they're going to be able to communicate with those first responders.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with a medication list. And you had a couple of suggestions for how you can assemble a medication list.
Right. One of the things that I do in the town is I go to the senior center. I actually will go anywhere to do it. And I recommend it for everybody, is to go over all of the medications, to keep a list of everything current, and you know, sit down with the person. Again, they prefer the person to be a nurse. They just feel more comfortable in, mm-hmm. in this town anyway. But it really could be a doctor, pharmacist, whoever. And prepare a list of any medications that they are currently on, contact persons, what any particular diseases that they might have, illnesses, things like you mentioned, if they are blind, if they are deaf, you know, that brings up another point. Service animals are allowed in shelters. It is,
not pets, but service animals.
Right, and now that's a law. That
right.
pets cannot come into a shelter unless they're a service dog.
Right, but there may be some special provisions, especially in an emergency, to make sure that the animals are not just cast adrift.
Exactly.
Because it was another lesson we learned out of Katrina, was that it was not a good idea to just abandon all of our animals.
So what we have here, we have an arrangement with a number of veterinarians, and they will take all of the pets. And all of them, they are all safe. And all we have to do, most everybody around here knows who the veterinarians are. And it's like, actually I've been over there a couple of times. It reminds me of an elementary school. You have every imaginable type of animal there.
Yeah.
They're well fed, they're clean, and it takes a lot of the pressure off, a great amount of pressure. Off of the people who own the pets.
Many right, because the animals get anxious too
in
an unusual circumstance. Let's talk a little bit more about the medication thing, because your town provides a free form to fill out and put on a magnetized holder on your refrigerator,
mm-hmm.
Where you can keep your medication list. And this is called a file of life.
Right, right.
So it's a very low tech. It's a piece of paper, basically, to fill out. And you were saying the best thing to do is to fill it out in pencil, right?
Yes.
So that you can update it easily. But you know, keep your medication list up to date and keep it hanging on your refrigerator, because the first responders are trained to look first on or in the refrigerator to find medications, to find, you know, make sure this person's been eating properly and so forth.
Exactly. That is the first place. They are trained to only look for it there. And if it's not there, they don't have the time really to run around and try to find what medications they're on, particularly
right.
if it's a real emergency. The very, very first thing that they do is walk into the kitchen and pull it off the refrigerator.
Right.
And if it's current, that's great. It makes them
so if you're there and can't speak for yourself, let's say you've passed out or something,
mm-hmm.
then you have that speaking for you. And if you need to leave, if you need to go to a shelter or something, you can just grab it yourself, and then you'll have it with you and all nicely, neatly in order.
You can, and they also come in little, about credit card size. It also comes in a little envelope. It says file of life on it. And it doesn't have a magnet, but it's something that you just put in your wallet.
Right, and this is something we'll have all the information in the handout that goes with this show, which is at powerfulpatient.org. And if you get the handout, you'll find the web reference for File of Life, or if you contact your local police department or your local fire department, they may have them there to give away. And we've talked before also about if you have more information that you would really want an emergency room to know about you, you might want to also have an emergent tag or some other way of compiling a larger set of medical information. So, again, we'll have the information about emergent tag on the handout for this program as well.
Now, there are three things, basically, when you talk about becoming prepared or having a kit. Everybody should have some form of a kit in their house. Make a plan for what you will do in an emergency. And that you need to consider a number of things. A personal support network. Do neighbors have a neighbor check on you? If there's somebody that you trust in your neighborhood or give them a key, exchange keys. So that if you see mail building up, you can go in, or call the police and they can go in.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a smart idea for people living alone to have somebody check on them if they don't hear any, you know, if they don't see them for a while.
That's right, and families need that kind of plan too, whether they're living together or not living together. I know when my sister's children were small, she was living in a wooden frame house in downtown Memphis, and you know, in a 100-year-old frame house, there's always some danger of fire. So she had fire drills with her children,
mm-hmm.
and the plan was that if they needed to get out of the house, they were to go and put their hands on the tree in the front yard and stay there until their mother got there.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually did have a small fire there once, and the firemen came and put it out. And one of the firemen came and said, "Miss Smith, you're going to have to come get your children because they will not leave that tree even with me." They said they have to stay at the tree with their hand on the tree until their mother gets there.
Right.
So so it was really good. It worked.
It
but that kind of rallying point or the telephone communication point, you know, in an emergency, we're all going to call Sarah because she's more likely to be home. Some plan like that is good to have in place.
You know, one of the things that's very important, everybody should have a battery-operated radio. And if told to evacuate, do so. People should not be martyrs. There are so many things that, even weather-related, people out on the ice when it's not safe, people, teenagers who want to try to prove that they're they're cool. You know, they want to impress somebody. Mm-hmm. And they'll go out when all the lines are down, all the tree limbs are down, and try to pick them up, and they find that there are live wires under there.
Right.
And these are the things that you want to teach the children, but in making a plan, having these drills within the house is extremely important. There's another thing that's important. You may need to stay where you are, and it's a little bit different than the lockdown. Sometimes you're safer just staying wherever you are until authorities tell you that it's safe to leave, and this is called shelter in place. And another term used is lockdown, but if it's the house, usually it's just shelter in place. And an example, you know, would be, something has happened.
Just like when the utilities are out.
Exactly.
So if the utilities are out, there may not be any heat. And the, let's say the weather is reasonably mild, you're not going to be able to cook. The gas is off and the heat is off. But in mild weather, that's not such a terrible thing. So you can stay in your house, but you may still need to have some special provisions on hand.
That's right. Another term that's used in some situations, if there are contaminants in the air, and this is kind of has come out from 9/11, and it's called sealing the room. And basically it's anywhere where something might come in, whether it's through a draft somewhere in the window or a door. There's all this plastic sheeting that's available that people can seal the room.
Oh, yes, I remember. I had some rolls of plastic sheeting and some duct tape to be able to seal the room around Y2K when we thought that some of the utility systems might fail and there might be some contaminants released into the air. But so it might be a good idea to just have some of that hanging around in your basement.
And, you know, we hopefully won't need to use that, but that is something that came out of 9/11. And whenever people hear about something possibly happening, the hardware stores are sold out of this plastic sheeting within an hour. The evacuation, again, depending on what the emergency is the basis of whether people should stay or leave the houses. And you want to find out if there is a shelter, and where is the shelter? A lot of it's common sense.
Right.
What people need to do when they move into a community, they don't think of a disaster. And one of the first things that they should really ask is, do you have a shelter? Where is it? How would I get there?
And sort of what are the emergency resources in your new community so
exactly.
that you're familiar with them. There was one other thing that you and I were talking about earlier, and that is to have photographs, not only of children, but also of elders.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Just in case you get separated, it's a good idea to have a current photo that's, you know, every 6 months or so you refresh your photos, so that you do have a current one that you could bring out. Because just in case you're separated, those first 48 hours are the most important, and the more rapidly you can get the information to the police and fire about who you're looking for and here's a current picture, the more probable it is that they're going to be able to reconnect you.
That's right. We have a fair twice a year on our town common, and it's for the whole community. It's a springtime fair, and then we have a harvest fair. And what emergency management does is we have a booth with the police and the fire department.
Right.
And that is where twice a year we take the pictures.
Great. So we've only got 1 minute left, so I just want to remind people to be sure to pick up the handout that goes with this show. If you're interested in EmergentTag, go to EmergentTag.com, and when you check out, if you put the code for VHL, that's like Very Happy Life, VHL, they will make a small donation to the VHL Family Alliance, which brings you this show. So that we hope that you'll do that. And thank you very much, Elaine, and I hope that everybody stays safe and prepares for all eventualities. I'm from the school of if you carry an umbrella, it's sure not to rain, right? Mm-hmm. So be prepared, and then you won't have any problems at all. But preparation is a very important thing, raises your own confidence, and make sure that just in case something does go wrong, that everybody will be happier and smoother. So I hope that you will be well and be a powerful patient. Thanks again, Elaine.
Sure. I was just going to add one more.
That's it.